You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 74 for December 9th, 2015. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk relationships, sort of. Should archaeologists marry each other? Is it really a good idea? We have some experience with this, and we'll wade through the pluses and minuses on today's show. We also are going to talk about, briefly going to talk about something that I've heard a lot about lately that I want to mention, and also we'll tackle a listener question. So, go sign up for Archaeo Tinder, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Bill in Arizona.
Howdy.
Doug in Scotland.
Hi.
Sonia from Utah.
Hello.
And Chris Sims in California.
Hey.
All right, so on today's show, we've got a couple things that we're going to talk about. First, though, I want to get into something that's really been kind of bugging me lately. I've had a relatively high number of people from very different sources either sending me names or telling me to talk about this topic on the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and I was like, yeah, okay. And then I thought over the weekend, last weekend, I was like, you know what? No, I don't really want to talk about this at all, and I'll tell you why. And the topic is transitioning out of archaeology. Now, if you're transitioning out of CRM into, say, another facet of archaeology, then that's fine. I'm more than happy to talk about that because there's plenty of ways to do archaeology and keep yourself happy. And in fact, I think people should consider those kinds of things. If you're not happy in, say, CRM, or you're not happy working for the BLM, or you're not happy, you know, working at a university or something, then there's other things you can do and stay in archaeology. That's perfectly fine. But talking about people about how they transitioned out of archaeology into, say, I don't know, working at the Gap or working whatever they're doing, you know, maybe they went and got another degree, maybe they did something. That's not the kind of stuff that I really want to talk about on the APN and on any of the shows in the APN. And really the reason is, I think part of what our mission is to make people happier and more content and find ways to increase quality of life. And if you're not happy doing archaeology, then I really don't want to help you get out of it. I want to help you stay in. And that's what I want to focus on. And that's my focus. That's always been my goal. It's been the goal with my blog posts, my book, you know, these podcasts, and that's been the thing, is increasing quality of life and keeping people here. Now, there's some dissenting opinions flooding through on the chat, and I'll start with Doug because he was the first one to chime in. Doug, why do you disagree? Why should we even talk about this?
Because I think when you're talking about if people should be happy, some people will be happy outside of archaeology, especially how the system's set up now. So most people go through university, they get a degree. They might do a field school, but we all know a field school rarely captures what actual archaeology is when you're out in the field, when you're doing CRM, when you're doing 99% of most archaeology. Even running a field school as an academic is very different than participating in one. And people don't actually really get a chance to try out archaeology before they become an archaeologist. And I would hate for someone to start a profession and realize they actually don't like it, mm-hmm. and they don't want to do it. And why stay miserable doing a job you don't want to do when you find it out? I think it's perfectly fine for people to try it out for a year or two, or your life changes. I think Bill was saying it earlier, people, you know, go to grad school and they're like, you know, so they could have a family. And sometimes being like a shovel bum is great in your 20s. You get to travel to all sorts of great places, dig some of the best archaeology of your life. But at a certain point, your knees are going to give out, your wrists are going to give out. You need to transition. And there are not enough positions in CRM for people to go to desk-based jobs. Mm-hmm. We need people to be able to leave the profession. I know so many bitter archaeologists who complain about, you know, how much they hate their job and how they'd like to do something else, but they don't know how to get out. So I would actually think we should do an entire series of podcasts about how to get out of CRM. Because I think, you know, it'd be better for people to be able to leave and do something they want to do. And I think A supportive profession is one that helps you into the profession, helps you grow in the profession, and then once you're ready to transition to something else, even if that's not in the profession, it helps you get there.
Right. Well, I see what you're saying real quick. I feel like we should focus on the other side, but yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I can kind of see both sides where you're coming from, Chris, and also where you're coming from, Doug. And I think the only thing I really have to add to that is that there's a problem of devaluing our skill set in CRM and also outside of CRM or any of the other facets of archaeology that we work in. And so, you know, we commonly think, you know, I myself have done this where we think, oh, well, we're going to leave archaeology and be a barista. And that's not to, you know, diminish the value of a barista, but, you know, like we're scientists for crying out loud. So like we can do other things. And there are a few successful examples of people who have left archaeology to be, you know, high paid project managers in the tech industry or other industries and stuff like that. And so I think maybe an emphasis on our skill set and really trumping that up might add to the value of both people who remain in archaeology to make us more successful archaeologists and also people who, for their own personal reasons or professional reasons, want to leave archaeology. It could add them some more value too, so that at least we see the value in the skill set of an archaeologist being something that can take us wherever we want.
I agree with the whole keeping the podcast focused on CRM. I mean, that's the niche, right? There's a million happiness and, you know, career building, life coach podcasts and blogs and, you know, workshops and everything that you can go to, right? So if we go away from the niche of cultural resource management and start getting into those other ones, then, you know, we're at a disadvantage, right? Because none of us are life coaches yet, or, you know, none of us really can add to these career development type of things outside of cultural resources. I wouldn't know what it takes to get ahead as a licensed nurse practitioner or an accountant or anything like that. I wouldn't know what it takes. But as far as the happiness thing, man, like, I'm not really worried so much about people getting happier by listening to the podcast, because the reason I do it is to try and share what I know and what I'm learning about cultural resources to help people be better CRMers. So their happiness, I mean, I meditate so that the world will be a happier place. I don't go on the podcast because of that. but you know, when the dream is faded of being an archaeologist, when being a scientist is just not enough, when you decide that you want to have more money to do these other things that you're more interested in, and you can't figure out how to do that with cultural resources, and you're sick of living in hotel rooms and stuff like that, by all means, you got to transition out. And if you do transition out, find all the other people who did that and create your own transitioning podcast. Like, you know, have another podcast about people who were sad at all their different careers and how they chose something else that's more fulfilling and makes their life, you know, a better place, right? But I just don't really know about the CRM podcast being the place, because I don't plan on being in archaeology forever, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But and I don't plan on being in cultural resources forever. And I have no idea how I'm going to get out, but when the time comes, I'll start listening to the podcast that someone who did it created for me.
I think you're going to start a CRM life coaching business. That's fantastic. Let's do that.
Well, what I want to do, I mean, I'm a Netflix addict, and I watched a thing about Yogananda, and I was like, huh, so this guy just sits around and meditates and does yoga all day, and he just has people pay for everything, and all he does is just sit there, like... Once my daughter's graduated, that's what I'm going to do. Just sit around and try not to think and have people pay for all my food.
Uh-huh. Nice. Doug, another comment?
Well, I would say that we should be the ones that have that podcast, because I don't think you're going to find many directions. And back to sort of Chris's thing about, you know, transitioning out to be a barista, I think – way too many archaeologists do transfer out to be, you know, work in essentially service sector jobs because they're the generic jobs they get. And I think, you know, it would be great to do a podcast on how your skills are transferable.
Agreed.
It's a huge thing. A whole thing at universities is like, oh, you know, a liberal arts degree is transferable and stuff. And it is, but no one's actually showing that. And I think we could do, we wouldn't be able to do specific, like, you know, this is how you become a financial advisor at Credit Suisse or whatever those different banks are, you know, something very specific. But I think we could have a really good podcast about how skills are transferable and how, as an archaeologist, you can get a job that's something other than waiting tables once you decide to leave archaeology.
I agree 100% on that one. I don't think that, yeah, I don't think that we we're considered kind of a jack of all trades.
Right.
We've got people who are educated in archaeology but have different levels of skill in soils, ethnography, photography, floral remains. You know, we've got human remains. We've got people with all this, all these skill sets. Not every one of us is going to stay in this forever. And, you know, the point that I wanted to make is that, yeah, your knees do give out on you eventually, or sometimes you're just not good at the job. You know, I have one friend who just didn't really, she wanted to stay home. And she was like, look, I can't keep traveling. I've got dogs. I want to be able to do something that's a little more local. And I can't do that in archaeology anymore. I have 3 degrees in archaeology and I can't do anything else. And so the difficulty for an archaeologist and finding someone who's transferred out of it is that those people are transferred out. You, unless you became good friends, you don't stay in contact with them. So you don't know how they did it.
Yeah.
The point here isn't to focus on getting out and how to become a barista or how to become a lawyer. It's basically the decision-making steps on deciding when it's time for you to get out and what it's going to take to move into a new, use your skill set to move into a new career.
Yeah.
Barista is actually my fallback career. I really want to work in a coffee shop, but that's another story.
I did that in high school. You know, it was fun, but boy, it smells in there. It smells like a lot of coffee and you'll get a headache.
Yeah,
if you've got a sensitive sniffer.
But really, I want to own a coffee shop so I have a nice place to go and somebody else runs it. So that's kind of where I'm at with that. Doug, one last comment on this?
Yeah, well, sort of picking up on Sonia's comment is actually, it'd also be good in this whole how to transition out and still stay involved in archaeology.
Yeah.
We have tens of thousands of people with archaeology degrees. I run into them all the time. People be like, oh yeah, my first degree was in archaeology. I did it 20 years ago. And they have almost no connection to the field whatsoever. It would be great to do not only how to transition out, but how to transition out, stay in contact, and possibly take some of your new skills that you've developed or this new career and bring it back to archaeology. Because we have people going out and becoming social media experts, coming out becoming film experts, things that I would say the profession really desperately needs but doesn't have that skill set. And it'd be great if we could keep people who also left but, you know, still were able to contribute and bring back something back to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really good point, Doug. I'm going to finish this off with one last comment. I'm not denying the fact that some people need to get out. You know, if it's just not right for them, and that's absolutely true. You shouldn't stay in if doing anything if it's not what your passion is, if it's not something you really love doing. Even if it is being a barista, some people that is their passion. I just watched the documentary called Barista on the National Barista Championships, which I didn't even know was a thing. But anyway. You know, I think my thing is I don't want to focus on it. I want to focus on, you know, okay, you have a problem with archaeology, you have a problem with CRM. Let's focus on what we can do to try to fix that. Maybe we can't fix it for that one person. Maybe they still have to get out, but maybe that's a problem that does have a solution. I mean, if they can do something else within the field, if it's a problem because, you know, they have kids in a family, which we're going to talk about later. Then maybe there is something else they can do, like you were saying, Doug, but still stay, you know, connected to archaeology. But focusing on how do I quit this job and do something else and what skills do I have that are transferable, I understand the utility of it, but it's, you know, like I said, I'd rather go the other direction, but that's just my personal thoughts on that. So anyway, before we go to our break, I want to move quickly into a relatively short listener question that I had a few weeks ago, and I've been waiting for this podcast to answer her. Her name is, we'll say Lexi H, because I don't know if she wants me to use her last name. Sonia, you know her.
Yes,
or at least, yeah, she said that in her email. She says she's a big fan, listens to all the podcasts, and she makes people in the truck listen to them as well. So people in the truck, how's it going? Thanks for listening against your will. So she wants to know, when you get offered a full-time position after being a temp, first off, congratulations if you're offered a full-time position after being a temp. And it's a super informal sort of thing. She said, do you send a thank you? She said, is that weird? She's not sure what the protocol is in the CRM field. And, you know, I responded to her in email, and I basically said, my take on this was, it really depends on your relationship with the person that's doing this. If they're like a friend and you hang out all the time, and it's not breaking any sort of rules company-wise to like maybe take them out to dinner or something like that. If that's not weird, then do something like that. If it's totally informal, and just say thank you. Or if it's somebody you're a little bit more disconnected with because they're the boss and they're up there, but they offer you to this position, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility to actually send them a thank you card if you want to. I mean, nobody's going to say, that's a weird thing to do. You know, everybody, it would be a totally unexpected thing to do. And mm-hmm. they would probably really, really appreciate it. Sonia, this is a friend of yours. What do you think about this?
It could go either way. I was raised in a German family where you sent a card for anything that you felt was appreciative. And it wasn't like a typed out letter kind of a thing. It's like a card, a handwritten card. It can be a short, hey, thank you so much for the interview, and I look forward to working with you. I'll be starting full-time on Monday. See you then.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's awesome. And given this day and age when everybody communicates digitally, a handwritten card especially is very thoughtful.
Yeah. And I prefer an internet card on Instagram, hashtag thank you. That's, 2015 way to do it.
You're so digital, Chris.
I know. I mean, anybody that knows me, if they were to send me a thank you card, they would know that, you know, paper just like fills me with dread and anger. So, you know, they would send me a digital card because they know me that well. So, Bill, go ahead.
Ironically, a paper card makes me feel better, so it's like the opposite way.
Yeah.
Send me my phone bill on paper, and I'm like enraged. Send me a thank you card, and I'm like, yeah, right on, you know? Thank you card, all the way. You guys are reminding me. I have this list, like I'm looking at it right now, of like 8 people who I owe a thank you card, and some of them have even written it out, and now we have stamps, and I need to mail them. So, yeah, thank you card. Go ahead, send it. At least a thank you card.
Well, like I said, Bill, you can convert mine to digital when you send it. So, you know, you can just scan it.
You were not on the list.
Oh.
Yeah. Awkward.
Awkward.
You know, overall, guys.
You guys have all seen Scrooge before, right? And he's choosing the presents. He's like, VHS, VHS, towel, towel, towel. You might make it to the VHS list.
Nice. Sonia.
Overall, guys, usually when you are offered a position, you usually say to that person, thank you.
Yeah.
And that is sufficient. Going the extra mile, and one of the things that I like to encourage people to do is just go that extra mile, take the initiative, send a thank you note. What's important is you're being noticed. And you're being noticed for in a positive way for being thoughtful. The hope is that they will recognize this, your supervisors will, and they will give you opportunities to learn more and move forward or move up in a job.
Yeah, I would add, even if you don't get the job, send a thank you card.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a big point. I didn't even think of that.
I've actually gotten two interviews, one job for after they told me that I didn't make it to the next round of interviews, I sent a thank you, and someone dropped out, and I got that interview because they basically knew who I was because I had sent a thank you card. In one case, a thank you email. But yeah, even if you don't get the job, a thank you is a pretty good thing to send, especially for an interview. And if you're also looking for feedback, and usually there's a reason. Sometimes the reason you didn't get the job is not that you weren't great. You usually are. Sometimes there's just someone who's just a little bit better than you are. But they'll remember you if you do send a thank you card.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think that handles that question. When we come back from the break, we will head into our primary topic, and we'll let Bill kick that off right after this. Hello, everyone. Chris Webster here from the Archaeology Podcast Network, and we're giving away an iPad Mini 4 to one of our listeners. The iPad Mini 4 came out in September. It's a 16-gigabyte space gray iPad with AT&T cellular-ready antenna. All that means is it comes with GPS. You do not need to get a data plan. And you don't even need to be on AT&T if you never get a plan to get a data plan. It just has GPS. It also has a fingerprint sensor and Apple Pay ready and all the good perks that come with that. So it's a good iPad. We use them in the field. There are two easy ways to enter. One, do a Profiles in CRM interview before December 15th, 2015, or recommend someone for an interview. You'll both get an entry once the interview is posted. If you want to know more about Profiles in CRM, go to www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/profiles. All the questions are listed right there. The other way to enter is to like the APN Facebook page and share it with your friends on Facebook to get the word out about our awesome podcasts. The winner will be announced December 16th, 2015 at 4 p.m. Pacific time. So get your entries in, send me those emails for people that want to do the Profiles in CRM podcast, and good luck to everyone. iMac, take us out with a binary solo. All right, we're back, and we're going to get into our topic for the day. Bill, why don't you kick this off and tell us exactly what we're talking about, and maybe when your blog post about this is coming out.
Yeah, totally. It's something that's been on my mind for quite a while, especially since I went back to school to become a graduate student. There's a couple of really great people that I've seen come to the University of Arizona, and they're really skilled, and they've been doing CRM for a while. And they go back for a master's in the applied program there. And whenever I ask them why they went back for their master's, they always have the same reason. Like, they were ready to maybe have a management spot. Maybe they wanted to be a more valued person by CRM companies by having the master's degree. You know, they can meet the Secretary of the Interior standards. They also have a chance to break through the glass ceiling because they'll have a graduate degree, so they can move beyond field tech, right? So they've spent a while doing field tech, but almost every time, at least half of the times I talk to former CRMers who went back for their masters, they always say, because I wanted to have a family, you know, I wanted to be a grown up. I wanted to get married, maybe buy a house, maybe have a nicer car, maybe have some stability in my life. And so every time they say something about, you know, buying a house, I always shake my head like, well, you can do that as a field tech if you really want to, right? It's not going to be easy. You're going to have to find the right thing. You're going to save money. You'll have to have a down payment, you know, all the stuff that comes along with buying a house, but you can do that. And then I used to think, well, I still do think, if you want to have, you know, children, what's preventing you from doing that? You know, this is your job as archaeology. There's a lot of people who have jobs where they travel a lot. What's to keep a field tech from doing that? But then I started to think about, well, what would happen if two field techs got married? You know, how would they manage a family? How would they have a house and have all that stuff? And so, yeah, there's a blog post that's coming out on Monday, which will be December 7th, on my blog. And it asks the question, can two field techs get married? And so the simple answer is, yeah, they can. You know, they can get married. And then I started to think about, okay, well, if you're married and even if you don't have a family and kids, the strain of either always being there with your spouse. I love my wife. Part of the reason why I love her is because I don't work with her all day.
Amen.
Nice. You know, and I married my wife, who is not an archaeologist, who actually, in fact, doesn't really want to hear very much about archaeology at all. Her eyes just glaze over the minute I start talking about archaeology.
But and she doesn't subscribe to all our podcasts?
That's no. What she does is she's aware that I'm recording a podcast, right? So that's as far as it goes. And then I tell her, you know, hey, we talked about this on that one. Oh, that's interesting. Like, you know, whatever.
That's what my husband does. Exactly. I'm not very nice. The same.
One bit, right? So, you know, she's not
good job, babe.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, good job. You know, well, we're out of milk. you know,
exactly. Oh,
well. Hang the laundry. That, oh well, that's something that matters to me. But at any rate, I didn't choose my wife because she wasn't an archaeologist. However, I think that her not being an archaeologist made her a little bit more attractive back when I was single, because when you're always around archaeologists all the time, you just you're talking about archaeology like all the time. And so learning about a whole new area of the world, basically everything besides archaeology, you know, that was, it was cool. We could have long conversations because she had a whole bunch of stuff to say that I didn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, so she's not an archaeologist. She has jobs that are in the towns where we live. And, you know, at sometimes my CRM job was the one that was paying the bills. And then other times her job was the more stable one that was paying the bills. But either which way, you know, we were, you know, married and doing all that stuff. But there's mm-hmm. times when I'm gone for like a month and a half, right? And so that's stressful. You know, we've had to deal with that in our relationship for years and years and years. You know, there's times when I'm just out in the field and she's left to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add in the kids and stuff, that just makes it even more complicated. So like, you know, when I'm gone, it seems to her like I'm just basically on a beach in Tahiti while she's stuck in Mordor, you know, with the kids trying to make all this stuff work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like, when I come home, there's kind of a like, yay, I'm glad you're home. Okay, I'm gone. I have a million things to do that are for me. You can stay mm-hmm. here with these kids and take care of it. And so trying to be a parent when you're only home like 3 days a week or like, you know, 8 days a month or something like that. Trying to be a husband and stuff when you're gone for so much of the time. That's stressful for a marriage. So you can imagine if your other spouse was also an archaeologist, mm-hmm. you know, how much more stressful that would be. And then finally, like the financial thing, I personally, I don't think that that's like an issue. I think it's more of an issue of, can your relationship handle it? And, you know, how are you going to be a parent if you're out in the field more than money? Because there's people who make a lot less than archaeologists and they've got kids and families and they raise them all the way up, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not, the cash shouldn't deter anyone from getting married or having a family or trying to buy a home or anything. Like if you don't have, well, I guess for a home, if you don't have the money to pay for it or, you know, to have a down payment, don't do something ridiculous. But seriously, you can afford something in most communities. The money is not a factor. It's more how strong is your actual relationship with your spouse?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like, how are you going to be able to parent when you're not there all the time? I don't know. What do you, Chris, Sonia, you guys, Doug, Chris, everybody, you tell me what you think.
Well, you know, I'll start because I've actually experienced pretty much all of that except for having children. You know, my wife and I met while we were field techs, and in fact, it was her second or third job, and it was my, technically, I think it was her second job and my first job that we met on. And we started dating on the next one after that, where we both got randomly on the same project together. And actually, we started dating well after that, but that's another story. You know, when we started dating, though, we were working with the same company. I came down there and it was we were on some of the same projects. You know, we were in the same hotel room, but we were in, you know, the quote unquote honeymoon phase of our, you know, growing relationship. So that was all OK for us. And then as we were with the same company, she was more in the lab and I was going out in the field. So we were dealing with separation things there. And then when we quit that job and we decided to just go full time shovel bumming. You know, we sold both our cars, bought one vehicle, a bigger vehicle, and traveled across the country for about 2 years and had the same jobs. We would always apply to the same jobs together. We said, if you get one, you want one, you get the other. And that always worked out for us. We were fully employed for a couple of years doing that all across the country. And for us, it really worked out. You know, we were able to work well together. We were never in a situation where one was a crew chief over the other. We were kind of moving up through the ranks together. And when we did become crew chiefs, it was at the same company at the same time. So we had our own crews. And, you know, we got married and we got married, what was it, about 5 years into our relationship or something like that. And then like 2 months later, she got out of archaeology and never looked back. So now I'm on the other side of it. Now I'm on the other side where I've been doing all the traveling. She's always at home and she doesn't really want to talk about archaeology. She could still hold her own in a discussion, but she's not, it's not like our primary discussion and what we talk about. You know, I own a company now and I'm running projects. So, and I've got this podcast, I'm pretty much knee deep in it. So she can't get away from archaeology most of the time. But, at this point in our relationship, we've been together since, 2006. A long time. And honestly, she's asked me before if she could work for my company. Like, she's doing another job. She wants to come back to archaeology kind of just because, you know, I'm running the show now. And, you know, her biggest problems with companies before was all the things that we complain about CRM companies. But theoretically, those aren't going to happen if we're calling the shots, right? Well, that's also a naive statement to make, but that's another topic for another show. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, once you get the big picture, you realize that some things are kind of unavoidable and some things are not. But anyway, now I'm not sure we could work together. It's a completely different relationship. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure it would work the same way.
You wouldn't have any teeth after the first month. They'd be kicked out.
My God. I'm telling you. I mean, it was great in the beginning. We worked together. We come back into the hotel room. You know, we spent 24 hours a day together. That was fine. Like I said, now, I don't know. I just don't think, and if we had kids, which she's talking about, she's 32 or something. And, I don't know how that's going to work out. I really don't. So, you know, Bill, I'll probably take a lot of cues from you on that one, but you know, I just don't know. Sonia, how about you? What's your story here?
Well, when I first started doing archaeology, I went into it with this, absolutely no, hell no, I am not going to date anyone on my field crews, anyone, even as a field tech. And I can confidently say that I never did that. Never dated any other archaeologists, which is good, actually. Mm-hmm, it turned out really well. It's lonely, let's just put it that way. But I also, I had met my husband in college, and he knew what I was going into. And we dated for, probably like 10 years or something like that before we ever got married. And when we did... Wow. He traveled a lot and I travel a lot. So it didn't really, since he's not an archaeologist, it was totally, you know, it totally worked well. The downside, of course, is that you can't get any pets, or at least we couldn't really get any pets. It didn't work well for us to do that. But I wanted a dog, so I got a dog. And so now wrangling the fur children has been a bit strange. Now, I know that's not the interesting part here. Then we fostered. For 3 years, we fostered a 15-year-old to 18-year-old girl. And that is complicated, partially because she's a 15-year-old girl and partially because there's lots of drama that goes along with that, a lot of coordination with her mom and dad. Medical situations, disagreement on religion, and some other, other things.
Right.
Kids can complicate things. I don't have any of my own kids. I'm, in a way, very happy about that because it would make life a lot more complicated, or maybe not complicated, just more difficult. And I feel kind of like my life's already difficult in some ways.
Well, you're running a company too, so...
I run a company too. So, it worked well while we had Mary, and Mary's doing great now. She's in college and she still comes back home on occasion. She still goes to see her parents on occasion. It works great. But we still have the fur children and, we just spend a lot of money at the kennel. Honestly, in terms of my husband, whenever he wants to provide suggestions on how to run my company or pay my employees, I just basically want to hurt him. His business is not the same as my business. And it's just a difference in, federal accounting regulations and what a private, consulting business like his can do. Right. So we have basically agreed that we don't discuss business unless I engage and then expect it to kind of go south about 15, 20 minutes into the conversation. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, just differences in opinion. But I don't know if I provided any you know, astounding news, but I can definitely tell you I never wanted to date any archaeologists. I wanted to turn that off when I got at home.
I think it is interesting that that a number of the people on this podcast right now didn't actually marry or date archaeologists, because I think people probably always assume that your dating pool is going to be archaeologists. And maybe early on, it really is. I mean, if you're going to shovel bum for the first 3 or 4 years of your career, your dating pool really is going to be archaeologists. You know, I mean, that's what else are you going to do? I mean, there's always the townies, but those are temporary. Maybe that's what you want. I don't know.
Maybe Dikes, that's the town. You mean you don't want to live in rural Nevada? Seriously?
Yeah. Or right? A right? Town in Alabama?
Yeah. You don't want to buy a house right. in Pioche?
I don't think so. No. I don't think so. So I want to move next to, let's have Doug comment first, and then I want to move over to Chris, because he's about where I was about 10 years ago right now. We'll get into that, though. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that it's probably changed, especially in the last 5 years or so, if you don't want to date an archaeologist, if you don't want to date your fellow crew members. I think it's gotten a lot better, because it used to be you're basically stuck out in the middle of the world, or well, middle of nowhere, on these digs. And I think that's changing quite a bit with now that internet dating is becoming more acceptable.
Socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you know, the new dating apps like Tinder and stuff like that, you could, and that's all geographically based. So, and if you're seeing most people coming out of university these days, they've switched over to the hookup culture. So you don't really date so much as hang out. And so I think in terms, archaeologists haven't changed, but the world's changed around us to make it easier to do what dating is today.
I was thinking this, and Bill put it in the chat too. I mean, I think Tinder brought the townies to you rather than you having to go find them.
for better or for worse, that's probably
right.
The truth.
Right.
Yikes.
Nice. All right. So, Chris, you are dating an archaeologist.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you're dating a serum archaeologist. And she's younger than you. You're actually almost in the exact same position I was in when I started dating my wife. I'm like 8.5, 9 years older than she is. And, you know, we were both at the beginnings of our career because of the way that I had come into archaeology. You know, I did the Navy first and aviation first, and then I came into archaeology. So we kind of synced up. In fact, we graduated in the same year, which was weird for us. But anyway, what do you think's going on over there? And keep in mind, I don't know if you've got your headphones in, Chris, but Andy might actually be able to hear this right now. I'm not really sure. she might be in the room.
She is in the same room, but she can't hear anything I'm saying right now.
Nice.
Or anything you guys are saying. She can hear my end.
Nice. All right. Well, let's hear your side of it, Chris. What's going on with that? Basically, when are you guys getting married?
No pressure.
Soon. I will say that it is part of the plan, but in a nutshell, I got it. Like, my story sounds very similar to yours, Chris. I got into archaeology almost a decade ago, and I had partners before then who were archaeologists, were not archaeologists. The first partner I had when I decided I wanted to do archaeology was not an archaeologist, and she was like, "What are you thinking? That's such a dumb idea." And, you know, like, I've had times in my life where I could have blamed archaeology for the demise of relationships, but ultimately, like, hindsight being 2020, those relationships were doomed to fail as they were. But the current relationship I'm in now, we've been together for almost 3 years, and we met on an academic dig in Portugal, and we've worked together in CRM. We've also worked separately in CRM, and it takes a lot of work. You know, like, navigating the relationship, but also navigating the balance between being coworker and partner. There have been times when I've been her supervisor. So yeah, it's, it's difficult. It's always finding the balance. And so it just takes a lot of work. And I think one of the recurring themes, like throughout archaeology, no matter like what you're really talking about, is like having realistic expectations about things and being really mindful about everything you're doing. And so, you know, like one of the lessons I've learned throughout the past is don't put too much pressure, or like don't burden your relationship. You know, like there's times when you just think, you know, your relationship is strong enough to handle certain things, but the distance, the instability of archaeology are like nothing to take lightly in archaeology. So it takes a lot of mindfulness. And something that Doug has said, you know, dating aside, I think the connectivity of our technology right now makes it a lot easier to keep good communication open. And so when you do have distance from your partner, you know, being able to FaceTime, being able to Skype, and also having better internet connection and better, you know, data connection with your phone all over the country and even most parts of the world makes it really easy to stay in touch and have like good communication. So it makes it harder to miss your partner that much.
That's a really good point. The communication aspect of it, because I know my wife and I, we, you know, FaceTime or Skype. Actually, we FaceTime because we both have iPhones. I probably, if not every day, every other day. And if we don't do that, we usually at least talk or something like that. You know, sometimes she'll work a closing shift where she works, and you know, we'll just text back and forth or something like that. But it's fairly constant communication. It's not like when I get home on the weekend or something like that, we've got to spend a few hours catching up. We're pretty much on the same page by that happens. I just got to make sure she cleans up the house before I get there. So, she has her own way. She has her own way of living when I'm not there.
That's true. That's totally true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we all do, you know, we all have our own ways of living. So, you know, that is the one thing I've noticed, before the break real quick that I'll talk about, is it's been really strange for us, especially on this current project, because I've pretty much been gone since April, but since June, we've been on a project where I've got a 2-bedroom furnished apartment rented. So, I mean, I moved a lot of stuff down here, actually. I'm in the process of moving it all back because the project is over, but we've essentially had our own places to live for the last like 6 months. And when I've gone home, you know, I don't even unpack my suitcase. I set it on the chest at the end of the bed, and I pretty much live like I'm in a hotel room when I'm at home. And then I unpack when I get into the field. So it's been a very weird situation, but we'll talk about some more of that, and we'll see if we can't answer some more of these questions. We got some other stuff to talk about this when we get back from the break.
Profiles in CRM, a weekly podcast. Ask CRM professionals 8 simple questions. The first questions establish education, location, and experience. The last questions are a reflection of that experience, and the answers will surprise you. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/profiles. On that page, you can also request to be interviewed for the show. It only takes 20 minutes, and you don't need any special equipment. Let's get back to the show.
All right, we're back for our third and final segment on the show. And in the background, Doug had a question wondering about, do relationships take a lot of work, but is it harder in archaeology? And I think it's an interesting way to phrase that question. We're all archaeologists, so we're talking about, is it harder in archaeology? But it's probably harder in any field where you travel a lot. I've known some airline pilots. They have hard times with relationships sometimes, especially in the beginning when they're getting all the crappy flights. You know, they're working all the holidays and all the red eyes. And, you know, when you move up in the world, just like archaeology, if you move up in position, there's a decent chance that you'll be transitioning into, you know, more of your percentage will be office rather than field. So if you can stick with it in archaeology, perhaps, and you know what? I'm just having this thought right now. Maybe this is genius. I don't know. How many people know people that got married when they were like, I don't know, 20, 19, 18? Hell, I did it. And then I got divorced because that was a stupid idea. So
yeah,
maybe
I know people like that. Wasn't me, yeah. But I know me people either. Like that.
Exactly. So these people, you know, like some of us right now that got married later on, I mean, it seems like maybe we should live our lives. We're living a lot longer as human beings. We're able to have children, you know, at a pretty advanced age compared to our predecessors, you know, hundreds of years ago, if not thousands of years ago. And I think maybe it makes sense. Like if you go the traditional route, you go to high school, you go to college, and then you start field tech, and maybe you go to grad school later on or something like that. And maybe you don't get into a serious relationship until you're, you know, you've got 10 years under your belt and, you know, you've dated and stuff like that, but you've got 10 years under your belt. You're moving into crew chief, maybe project management. That's when you can start staying home a little more and then maybe put in the time into a relationship that it could need. You know, I don't know. What do you guys all think about that?
I'm just interested. I want to hear more from Doug because he just said that he started dating his wife at 19 and he is breaking that mold that you were saying of the early marriage. So, Doug,
That's true.
Yeah. I met my wife freshman year of university, and we, surprisingly enough, we were probably in a similar situation to what it's like to have a relationship in the field in archaeology, but it wasn't archaeology. So we met because at the University of New Mexico, they do orientation, but they do it you go for 2 days, different weeks during the summer, you sign up for your classes and stuff. And we are orientation leaders. So we'd show the new students around the campus, help them sign up for their classes and stuff like that. And it was a very intense experience because one of those days was a 16 or 17 hour day. And then we basically were in the dorms together. So we ended up living right next to each other. And the people we worked with, we worked with them, we lived with them, we basically saw them all the time. And occasionally you might have a Friday afternoon or a weekend away, but usually actually we ended up, most of us were under 21, so of course we weren't drinking on campus at that time, but, you know, hanging out. And so it was a lot like a archaeology relationship when we first got together, which is you live with the person, you work with the person, you see them all the time. And obviously we didn't do that for forever. And I don't know if I'm the best person to speak about like having good, healthy relationships, but it's been a decade and we're still together. So I'm not sure. I know I've known quite a few people who did get married quite young and it hasn't worked out, but for us it did.
I think that there's something to, you know, your experience, Doug, and also kind of the experience that some of us have in archaeology where the close quarters and just like really never having a break from someone, it can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. I'd say in my experience right now with my current partner, it was a good thing. We lived together and got to see each other at their best and their worst all in like the first almost 3 months of a long field project. And, you know, like before we ever even thought that we would date each other, I got to know this person quite well. And, you know, like as far as bringing that back to the main question, are relationships harder for archaeologists? I don't think that they're necessarily harder than anybody else in the general public who's maybe, you know, traveling a lot or even military families, stuff like that. I just think that maybe us spending so much time together and having so much close quarters in uncomfortable situations where we're tired, we're filthy, we're, you know, mentally fatigued as well as emotionally fatigued, I think that it can really make things, I don't know, you learn a lot very quickly.
You do that indeed, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it makes it harder to have a relationship personally, but I don't know what to say about parenting because I didn't have kids when I was a tech, but I have had them since I've been a CRMer, and I know that it's hard to raise kids if you're not there every day or all the time. You know, it's hard, and you know, my fact of being in the field so much is what motivated me to go back for my PhD because my kids were little. And in those first, like, you know, 18 months, 12 months, it depends. I've heard of these miracle babies that sleep through the night. I don't know about those babies because my kids still don't sleep through the night. My son's five. But, like, I mean, you are worn down when that baby's born, especially the first one, exhausted. So, talk about no sleep at all, and then your husband's in a hotel room somewhere sleeping all night long. Like, you know, if you can only imagine the jealousy or the feelings behind that. But then also try, you know, running crews even out of town. And I've had to do it many times on like 2 hours of sleep, 3 hours of sleep, because your kid is up all night long, every hour.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with that, right? And if you don't deal with that, God forbid you actually just sleep through the kid crying. There's someone who's dealing with that, and she remembers every time that you sleep through the crying and changing the baby at night. That doesn't go away. So it's super stressful, and you can imagine how hard that is. Just, you know, everyday people who, you know, live in town and stuff, it's hard to have a newborn. And then add to that, you know, the fact that one or two people are out of town all the time. I just don't really see how you can have children in that situation. And then the other thing, what you need to be a parent changes throughout the child's life. So what an infant needs is way different than a teenager or, you know, a kid who's in elementary school. So, you know, you're staying up all night long with the infant for one reason, and you're staying up all night long with the teenager for a whole different reason. You know,
oh, yeah.
The reaction that ends up happening, you know, the way that you have to deal with things and how you have to be there. If one person is in the field, and your daughter gets a DUI or something like that, like that's, you're left to deal with it all alone, you know? And, you can imagine, the only way I can see that you can be a parent if both people are field techs or out in the field all the time is if the mother or sister or some other family or friend is taking care of the child, because somebody's got to actually be there with that kid all the time. And you can have daycare during the day, or they can go to school and all that stuff and aftercare. But seriously, someone has to be with that child at night and in the morning and on weekends. And if you're out in the field doing stuff, someone has to be there. And the only way you can have a kid is if your family or friends step up, because it just pretty much cannot be done if both parents are out in the field.
That's true. And, you know, I think it even goes to, even if you don't have kids, it can be difficult depending on your lifestyle. If you own a home or something like that with your significant other, and you're gone in the field during the whole summer months, when we all know owning a home in the summer months, there's a lot of things to take care of. There's lawn to mow. There's, you know, yeah, there's maintenance just owning a home. And then there's even more in the summertime. And maybe you can't do that every 2 weeks when you're home. So the other person is going to have to step up and do all that stuff while you're sitting in a hotel room with maid service. You know, they are required to keep the house going. And I know there's plenty of single up people out there that do that. But when you're married, you kind of come into the expectation that you're going to have help doing that. And then, you know, the person's gone in the field all the time and you don't have any help doing that. And that can be frustrating for people, just even just psychologically, even though they know they can do it. Psychologically, it's like, why do I have to do all this? You own the house, too. You know, you live here, too. But I'm stuck, you know, carrying the load. So, Doug, you had a comment on this real quick.
Yeah, it was mainly just to sort of pivot a little bit back to what Chris Sim said, and about the sort of intensity of a relationship when you're in the field and you're an archaeologist. And it is, I think it is really tricky as well, in the sense, so when my wife and I got together, we were flirting in the first couple of weeks, and I had made a conscious plan to not do anything about it until after the job was over. She had different ideas, and obviously she won out. But in that same job, we actually had someone who, someone who was fired, and in circumstances we didn't like. There was people who had relationships and broke up. Another couple ended up having a child. So, the intense work relationship, I think there was 22 of us. And 16 people got together, so 8 couples out of that staff. Some of that happened while we were all working very intense, and it's when relationships fall apart in the field. I think it makes it really difficult to have any sort of relationship if you're an archaeologist and you are in that intense work environment where I don't know. It depends where you're working, but sometimes it can be 10 days. You're living with someone, you're working with someone, and you're out in the middle of nowhere. So it's just basically you and a couple of other of your fellow archaeologists. And it's a pretty hard to negotiate that if stuff starts to go south, or stuff starts to go south with other members of the crew, where, you know, crews start to break up and split up, where one member of the couple dislikes someone else. So it's awkward because then the other person in the couple can't really hang out with, you know, it's all those relationship stuff. So I think it is one of those really hard, difficult things to do in terms of archaeology. It just, if you're in that such an intense environment.
Yeah, I've said many things on this podcast, which people have emailed me over. But exactly what you're talking about is why I don't really like working with couples in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Because almost every time, I mean, I'd say a small percentage of the time, it's civilized people like Chris Webster and his wife that actually can handle being together with each other all the time. And most of the time, especially these longer digs, 6 months, 12 months or whatever, people start hooking up. Oh, field school is another example too. People start hooking up and then everything falls apart. Yeah, Chris Sims is another example of a success, but they're seriously like the few of the dozens of couples I've seen, you know, totally implode. And then, you know, as a manager or as someone else on the crew, you have to deal with that kind of stuff that's happening in the field. And like, it's just, it adds extra work for you, which is why I really just don't like working with couples.
Yeah.
I just don't like it. And I can't get over it because there's been so many bad problems that if I even hear about it, it changes my whole like attitude and stuff like that. And it's very hard to get over.
Yeah, totally. It makes it hard to really find the balance between, you know, being a professional coworker and, you know, being a partner, or even, you know, on your end, Bill, if you're supervising someone, you know, like how do you draw that line and say, you know, like you're coworkers for Christ's sake, and then, you know, but they're also partners as well, but they're bickering, you know, it's like, how do you treat that as like couples intervention or like an HR issue?
HR issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an HR issue, except for you're 500 miles away from the HR, you know, yeah, person that can sit you down and say, okay, now tell me what happened, civilized, in a very civilized manner. It's like,
yeah,
you've rented 10 days worth of hotel room and these people were supposed to stay with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like they have 8 more days to be human beings before they can possibly get away from each other. Or, you know, I don't know. It's just, or just the trivial stuff of sabotaging each other. So now someone else has to do extra work because the other person is purposefully causing problems.
Good grief.
To hurt the other one. You know, it's just, I just really don't know what to say. The HR issue, like, there's one company I worked for and we had to watch this, sexual harassment video. It was like a 1-hour video or something like that, and it described what harassment was. Then at the end they were just like, and if you look on page 25 of the contract you're about to sign, it says don't date anyone on the field. If you feel like you have to date someone in the field, you must tell us before you start dating. If you start dating before you tell us you want to date, you're gone.
Exactly. I generally try to treat that as an HR issue, and I've only had to deal with it a few times. And I mentioned in some of the comments that sometimes male-female relationships, especially when they involve a triangle and not a line or 2 points, can get kind of complicated.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, first of all, if you're the field director, you don't. Just don't. Don't get involved with anybody on your crew. There is that will be nothing but problems for you. I know it's tough, but just deal with it. You need to be the mediator, and you need to set the good example and remind your crews that they need to be professional. And if they can't be professional and maintain their professionalism so that they're doing their job, they need to be off the crew. And that's just kind of how it is.
Yeah. And I think that that's not too much to ask either, because that's a good lesson to teach someone as a good employee, but also as a good partner, you know, to keep it together while they're in the field.
Yeah. You can have a disagreement. That's perfectly fine, but you maintain your professionalism while you're working. And if you need to have that knockdown, drag out fight, you do it in the hotel room or, if you like doing it in public, some McDonald's somewhere way off the strip.
Yeah.
You know, and then you remain professional back in the field the next day. If you can't do it, you're not dating the right people.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think they start off as the right person till that third, you know, person in the soap opera triangle enters the picture. Then magically they're not the right person. And then that's when everything starts falling apart. And some mm-hmm. people just don't have the emotional stability to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, I didn't want anything. One of the reasons why I said that I didn't ever want to date an archaeologist in the field is because I know I have a very strong personality. And if I get pushed to the point where I lose control, I'm not fun to be around. So I knew that that dating in the field was probably not the right thing for me, which is why I chose to do what I did. You know, and that was a personal choice.
Well, before I met my wife, I dated other people who were techs who I hope are not listening to this thing right now. But it was complete failure. You know, either everything fell apart and then they started dating someone else on the crew, which, you know, was mm-hmm. bad for me, or I did the same thing, or like, you know, we're trapped together and then one person gets promoted or whatever and they just can't get over it. It was just not good. And the relationships were just like fast. They burned out like super fast because we were with each other all the time. So, I don't know if that contributed to moving towards, you know, dating my wife or dating outside of archaeology or whatever, but, you know, probably.
Nice. Well, this is the kind of transitioning out of archaeology I can talk about. So transitioning out of archaeology partners. All right. So we're going to end this real soon, but I did want to bring one thing up real quick that we talked about earlier, and that was conversation and taking a break from archaeology when you get back home, like Sonia and Bill can do, because they, you know, didn't date somebody in archaeology. And I'm so knee deep into all this stuff. It's like all I do talk about at this point. So it's kind of awkward for me not to be able to talk about archaeology when I get home, because I really want to do that. I'm not really tired of it yet. I don't mind talking about, you know, and now I don't just talk about field work or how much my crew is pissing me off right now, Chris, and how much. No, just kidding. You know, I don't want to talk about stuff like that. I mean, I just want other stuff. You know, I've got the podcast network going on and some other things going on, but it's all kind of archaeology related. And for me, that's a good thing to have. And I do wish, you know, I do wish my wife would talk about that a little more, but of course she doesn't have a frame of reference for that anymore, so I can't expect her to really keep up with that kind of conversation. But, you know, really it's find what you want. If you don't want to talk about archaeology all the time, maybe you should find somebody that also doesn't want to do that, or that isn't in archaeology at all like we're talking, or, you know, maybe you find somebody that is just as into it as you are and it works out as well. So I don't know. Just keep your eyes open for whatever works right, you know. All right. I think we're going to stop this right there. We could probably go on talking about this for days and days and days.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a topic we'll bring up again later, and maybe we'll bring up some dating experts in archaeology later on, and some people that have had a lot of success with some of the stuff that Doug was talking about, like some of the online dating. I think that'd be a halfway decent topic, because this all does go back to what I was saying at the beginning of the show about keeping people, you know, keeping up quality of life and keeping people happy so they stay in this field. And one of the big sticking points for getting out of archaeology is you can't ever make a relationship work. Everything is temporary. Everything is, and for some people like that. Some people like the fact that all the relationships they have are 3 to 6 weeks long, because that's the length of the project.
Or because they've watched a lot of James Bond flicks and think that that's
right.
Hey, before we go, let's spend 1 minute talking about the, you guys all know the Archaeo Nomad, the woman that ever wants to go home because CRM's her life. She's at the office mm-hmm. like all day and all night. Or the guy who's in the field who like pretty much sleeps in his Toyota pickup truck because he has nothing else to do. He's there like way before he's supposed to be at work. He never wants to stop digging at the end of the day and like stays there way longer. And like when you start learning about their lives, you learn that they just had like nothing but disastrous relationships and their family's just gone. And archaeology is the only thing they have left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that kind of person is probably present in any workplace.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, I think you're probably right, Chris. And also, I just like to put out a little public service announcement to those guys, especially that are the older guys on the site that have been either probably the ones that are more like field techs or crew chiefs like their whole career. They never really moved out of that. So they're always in the field. You got to know at which point it starts becoming creepy that you're hitting on the 23-year-old girls. Okay. You got to know. Like at what point that switch flips? It's different for everybody. So, you know, learn how to read body language.
just learn what the middle finger means and you should be okay.
Right. Nice. All right. Well, on that note, I think we will end this show and we'll come back again with another exciting topic just like this one. All right. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRMArcPodcast, or you can tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMArc so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye.
Adios.
Bye.
that actually wasn't terrible. That was good.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.